Okay, thanks Marty for inviting me here, and I must apologize if I sound naive when I'm talking about genetics, because in fact I'm not a geneticist. I'm usually this talk is supposed to be delivered to computer scientists or sometimes statisticians, and they were happy because they find applications of their technique in fancy problems. But I took advantage of the fact that they don't know much about the terminology in genetics, so I sound knowledgeable. But here I guess I will sound pretty naive, so please don't hesitate to point to me any mistakes or ignorance I had in the talk. So I'm going to talk about Bayesian methods for a number of genetic inference problems. Since I'm pretty new in this community, let me also introduce myself and my group a little bit in terms of what we are doing. So here is my group in Carnegie Mellon University. As the name suggests, it is called the Laboratory of Statistical Artificial Intelligence and Integrated Genomics. So it's a combination of machine learning and biological applications. And here are graduate students and postdocs with me. And we work on a wide range of applied and theoretical problems. On the theoretical side, we mainly focus on developing methods and theories for learning and reasoning and uncertainty. And here are highlights of a few questions we are currently studying, such as learning structure input-output space. The name sounds odd, but they have solid applications in various areas, such as if you want to do whole genome association mapping between the phenome and the genome, that can be classed as a structure input-output regressional problem. We also study nonparametric Bayesian methods for doing inference in unconstrained open possible worlds, and today you are going to see a few examples of this technique in genetic problems. We also study quite heavily recently on the evolution, formation, and the dynamics of networks. And if some of you are interested in that area, we can also talk it offline. Then we also worked on a number of real biological application problems using some of the technique we developed, including study the regulatory genome in some model species such as the Drosophila. And also we recently get interested into computer vision and image analysis of the embryonic genesis process of Drosophila. And we've been talking to Marty and a few other people about how to shape up this project. And lately, we also study a number of genetic variation and disease association problems, building models for estimating recombination patterns and for estimating associations and causal elements in the genome to various complex phenotypes. And again, if you're interested, please feel free to intercept me and talk about these issues. So what I'm going to focus today is to discuss a number of problems associated with this type of data. I'm not going to give the introduction about this data because you guys know pretty much more than what I do about this data. It's basically the polymorphisms in our human genome, which can lead to complicated phenotypic effects and also may be indicative of human migrational history. Our goal is to develop computationally tractable, but still more or less realistic statistical models for the distribution of this type of data so that we can ask queries about that, such as missing value inference problems, say the haplotype of the SNPs, or where are the recombination spots on the genome, and how their ancestors look like, and things like that. So in order to develop such a model, let's first review a little bit about where this data may come from, which is actually widely assumed to be coming from a version of the coalescent process. So we have a bunch of ancestors, and they gave rise to descendants. And after a few generations, you're going to see the data we're going to run into today. And usually, people will take away those intermediate individuals who lost their descendants and worry only about those people that can be connected backward to a most common ancestor. And this structure is often known as a coalescent tree. Given this structure, you can actually theoretically write down a joint distribution of the modern individual, which involves a complicated marginalization process to sum over all possible tree topologies and dynamics to produce a structure, which is computationally infeasible if you want to do inference. I think forward simulation is possible, but doing backward inference can be quite difficult. And our goal is to come up with some approximations to this structure so that we can still do a reasonable amount of inference. So let's put some concrete data on top of this structure. Say we have a ancestral sequence in the founder. And when they gave rise to descendants, they can develop mutations here and there. And the common assumption goes that you cannot have more than one mutation at the same spot, you know, over the evolution history. Therefore, you know, at each site on the sequence, you are most likely to see at most two different types of configurations. And this type of information are known as a single nucleotide polymorphism, and there are some genetic ways of referring to that. And some of these mutations can be very interesting in reflecting the evolution history and maybe even phenotypic associations in different subpopulations. Usually people want to study those polymorphisms specifically, therefore we ignore those regions which does not develop any mutations and focus only on the polymorphic region. Now if we look at a bunch of polymorphic sequence sites on a single chromosome, then they form a sequence of polymorphic patterns known as the haplotype, which really refers to the joint configuration of multiple SNPs on a single chromosome. And so this is called a haplotype. And the haplotype can be interesting because sometimes they contain interesting evolutionary event that may reflect, may cause interesting phenotype, such as a disease phenotype or some other body features and so on and so forth. And some, therefore, it is actually interesting to ask, first of all, when such event can take place, or how strong is the association between a potential causal SNP that you don't observe with some other SNP that is in LD with that, which you do observe, and so that you can make predictions over the likelihood of a human being to develop specific phenotypes. For simplicity, we use a binary representation of this kind of data because, as I said, at each site, you at most see two different variants of the SNP. Therefore, we use a 0-1 to indicate that data. Therefore, our input data will be a bit string of some length for each chromosome of each individual. And the question we are interested in asking about this kind of data, at least in this talk, we'll be focusing on the following three aspects. First, we want to determine the kind of genetic markers which are indicative, possibly, of human phenotypes. And usually, such markers are better to be defined on a single chromosome rather than a pair of chromosomes we have in our cell. And this is called a haplotype inference problem. And interestingly, such data are not directly observable in the most common biological experiment. And I'm going to talk about a model to do such inference. I understand that this seminar is really not about haplotype inference, but more about, you know, recombination structure and other things. But I hope using this model, I can motivate a reasonable approximation to the coalescent process that define a proper and tractable distribution of haplotypes. And this problem is nice in the sense that you can validate the goodness of the model by comparing to the facts, because we do know the haplotype of individuals after paying a higher cost in sequencing. Therefore, by scoring the performance of haplotype inference, you somehow had a sense about how good the model can be. And the second problem is about how to use a model like this to do interesting inference, such as revealing the genomic inheritance event, such as recombination hotspot identification.
Eric,
yeah?
Just to understand this cartoon, so the thing in the right is the thing in the left, it's just that you have the haplotype, which is latent, you have the genotype, which is observed, and then the cartoon on the right just means you're trying to infer the true haplotype.
Yeah, I'm going to actually show this picture again and explain in detail about what do I mean by that. And thirdly, I also want to scratch the surface of a broader problem where you want to, you know, discover populational structure and ancestral spectral analysis. Okay, so this is a graph you probably saw over and over in recent papers in Nature and Science, which use a structured program to do genetic analysis. And actually, I'm going to point out some potential risk and problems with this program and propose a solution to that. Okay, so here's the outline of my talk. For each problem, I'm going to propose our approximate models and a quick inference algorithm to solve the problem. Now, the first problem is about the haplotype inference, and the problem arises from this phenomenon. So we human beings are diploid individuals, therefore we have two copies of our chromosome, one from the father and the one from the mother, and each copy had a unique haplotype, hopefully. But if you know, these two haplotypes are different in your body, then we are a heterogeneous diploid individual, and the haplotype really correspond to the exact chromosome association of each haplotype to a chromosome. But are this information observable directly from a trivial biological experiment? In fact, it is not necessarily observable, because when we do genotyping, usually what we do is to pick a piece of tissue and homogenize it and sequence. And in the end, at each location, you are likely to see two peaks, each one indicating the nucleotide on one of the chromosomes in your cell. And therefore, this is called a genotype, which is reflecting a pair of alleles whose association to the chromosome are now lost. Now, given this information, it is actually non-trivial to reconstruct that information because, for example I gave here, you can easily convince yourself that these two reconstructions are equally likely to explain the data. Therefore, it is impossible to, you know, exactly infer the haplotype if I gave you just one individual. So now we ask, is this problem actually solvable at all or not? Well, if you do have only one individual, like I gave it in here, now represented as binary data, you cannot really break the tie between equally likely explanations in terms of haplotype configuration. However, remember that I said earlier that our haplotype are actually derived from a evolution processes which could be described by a tree. Therefore, you know, they are created by some amount of mutational event in the history. And it is reasonable to assume that in order to produce a common current population, you want such event to be as few as possible so that you save some effort for the nature. Okay. Therefore, let's say in here, I have the second haplotype, second genotype. And again, I can come up with multiple hypotheses explaining this, but one of them had a hypothesis which is identical to this one. So these two things actually are sharing the same haplotype indicated by this green one. And we say that haplotype inference might be more plausible. So essentially, there is a bias toward a more parsimonious explanation of the genotype event.
I don't see why there's a difference. I don't understand which is more parsimonious then.
This one is not parsimonious because you now need only three haplotypes to explain these two individuals. And this one, you need four haplotypes to explain that. You see that?
No.
Okay, so here, for example, I have a haplotype 11111, and paired with this one, I can now form a consistent hypothesis about this genotype. Right? You can see this 21010101, and so on. And here, I can reuse this haplotype, the green one, and pair it with another novel haplotype to explain this data. Therefore, altogether, I need only three haplotypes to explain, you know, two genotypes. Right? But if I don't have a bias, then these explanations are equally likely because, you know, if you pair each of the sites together, they give you a consistent explanation of that genotype. But on the other hand, it requires four different haplotypes. You can imagine that if I have more and more individuals, to the order of hundreds and thousands, you can really, if you ignore the relationship between individual, you can just look at one by one and independently generate a pair of haplotypes, and that will, you will likely to have a lot of haplotypes. But this story says that indeed the haplotypes among multiple individuals are tied together through a coalescent process. Therefore, you want to make, you know, a more economical use of the haplotypes in the population. And our goal is to...
I'm so confused. I mean, the time is going down, mm-hmm. the bottom picture.
Yes. Here, there isn't time here. It's just...
The tree is going down.
The tree, right. Okay, and this one corresponds to where you see in the bottom.
So these string of ones don't have a common ancestor.
The string of ones don't have a common... These two things. Okay, each of the column here, okay, yeah. might correspond to a leaf in this tree. Okay, and therefore, since they are tied together by, you know, the tree, which is not observed, you want to produce as fewer number of leaves as possible, in a sense. Fewer number of different leaves as possible.
So the central strand is both copies of somebody's genome, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. this is just a physical representation of what you see in a sequence experiment.
So
these are actually the chromosomes.
Implied.
You're seeing the sequence, but you don't know which is from which.
The data you have are the strings in the middle.
Right.
If you look above the strings in the middle, there are four distinct
strings. Maybe use some other tools in the plantation.
Only three distinct strings. So the bottom solution is simpler than the upper solution. Because the upper solution required you to hypothesize four distinct strings that would generate the two strings that you have.
Well, there are two possible solutions to be the one in the middle.
There's many possible
solutions. Right, but these are an example of two solutions.
Yeah.
Okay.
And on the above choice, you have to generate four distinct substrings.
Right.
On the bottom choice, you have to generate three distinct substrings to generate the observed data, which are in the middle. And so that's why the bottom solution is the simpler of those two possible alternatives.
Okay, am I clear about that? So this one and that one, they are, you know, two haplotypes, but they look identical, so they correspond to, you know, these two leaves in here, right? And the third one correspond to a different branch and all that. And you want the diversity of this haplotype to be as, you know, as homogeneous as possible, in a sense. And our goal is to come up with a good model which actually bias the distribution toward this. Okay. After I present you a few solutions, you may get a deeper insight about what they actually mean by, you know, a parsimonious hypothesis. Before I talk about our model, let me briefly outline some of the existing solutions. One of the earlier solutions to this problem is just to use a standard finite mixture model. You write down the distribution of the genotype as a mixture of a pair of haplotypes. Condition on which a genotype is formed. And this distribution could be noisy because your genotype doesn't have to be completely consistent with the haplotype due to observational errors. But then here, you do have a prior distribution for the haplotypes, and then here you sum over all possible haplotypes in your sample space. And this is often known as a population haplotype pool. This is known as a haplotype model, and this is known as a genotype model. And effectively, this model doesn't give you a constraint or a bias over a fewer number of haplotypes. What people do in practice is to constrain the size of this pool so that I prefer, for example, the pool to be of a k, which is much smaller than the total number of haplotypes that is possible for this data. And there are some other simplifications, such as a Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, so that you can write down the joint distribution of a pair of haplotypes into a product of their individual frequencies. And in the end, what you have is a latent variable estimation problem. You do EM algorithm over empirically chosen K and an empirically designed pool to, you know, iteratively update the estimate of the frequency of the haplotypes. And by the way, as a side product, you also estimate what is the haplotype for each individual. So that's kind of a standard mixture model setting. This model isn't very good because you need to, you know, come up with a reasonable guess to the k and to h. And when the data set is very big, such guess cannot be easily made. The second model, which is actually a well-known and a pretty elegant model, goes like follows. It actually wants to better approximate what is happening in the coalescent process. And this model is known as a PAC model, stands for product of approximate conditional distribution, which can be somehow summarized in this graph. It assumes that now you have an ordering of all the unobserved haplotypes in the population, and then you pick one of them randomly to be the origin, to be the first founder, and then sequentially visit each of the other haplotypes and assume that each one you visited is a mutated version of a randomly chosen one from the one you already visited. If we have this tree, you have this chain structure where you go that direction, and each of them can be derived from one of the early ancestors in this ordering. And by doing this, you can now simplify the joint distribution of these N haplotypes as a product of conditional distributions. The first one is a marginal over the first ancestor. The second one is a conditional of the second one given the first one. The third one is the condition of the third one given the first two, and so on. Okay. So this is based on a chain rule. And then you're going to plug in your favorite mutation model to basically characterize how likely a mutation is going to take place given this ancestor and the current haplotypes. So this model is interesting in the sense that it does give you a very simplified representation of the joint distribution, but it has some issues to be concerned about. First of all, what does this ordering mean? Basically, this by writing down this joint distribution, this simplification of the joint distribution, you already implicitly assume there is an ordering among the individual. Therefore, your likelihood function is an inexchangeable probability distribution. If you change the order, you see something else. And secondly, there isn't really a real notion of ancestry here, because all the haplotypes here are from the current generation, and you are not really going back in the history to place physically a variable representing the ancestor. Therefore, the kind of mutational effects between these haplotypes are a pseudo likelihood type of description of the mutation. But on the other hand, this simplification makes the modeling a lot easier than working with directly the coalescent process, and in effect, in performance, Matthew Stevens showed that it is an extremely powerful algorithm to do the haplotype inference in the quick fashion and in a very accurate fashion.
Is there a limit where this is correct? Maybe when you have very many haplotypes? When does this algorithm work best? If you have few?
It seems to be working quite well over a wide range of data. There isn't a systematic study in terms of the statistical property of this model. But in practice, I personally tried this method on various data sizes, and they do pretty well, pretty stably. I'm giving you a simplification version of that. There are other ingredients in the model which makes the model more powerful.
If the P's were actually correct, then you'd be doing correct inference.
What's that?
If the P's were actually correct.
Oh yeah, if the P's.
And then you'd be doing the real thing, and it would be exchangeable, and you would have ancestry via the P's.
Okay.
But if it's an approximation, that's when it's not going to be much.
Yeah.
And in practice, they swap around the ordering?
Yeah, that's one thing I think. In practice, when they do the sampling-based inferences, they do swap over a number of different ordering and average the result. Okay, but they report in the paper that this is not very substantial, because it doesn't change it out too much in practice. Okay, so that's the second model.
Same friend that you treated by Hardy-Weinberg before, by just saying, I'm just going to factorize? On two slides ago, you just took this thing and said it's the product of the marginals.
That's a different thing. The Hardy-Weinberg assumption is saying that the pair of haplotypes from the single individual are independently inherited. And here I'm talking about really a different assumption.
It's a different assumption.
Yeah.
So in your population, you may have some individuals who are homozygous.
Okay.
Or have a single variant.
Sure.
In those cases, you will know the haplotype.
Oh, yes.
With high confidence. So are you taking that information into account when you apply?
We're not making special treatment to that. It is, of course, subsumed into this model, but it's like we don't take them out. And if you want to do a aggressively more, tricky, inference, in fact, I think Andy Clark did that. You first, look at the homozygous cases and infer a few founding or seed haplotypes and then try to enrich the pool of haplotypes. I think the goal in here, in Marcio's model and in my model, are not really making this special arrangement. We want to make the model more generic and deal with generic data sets. But we could actually do this engineering and make the model a little bit better behaving. Okay, so here is the second model. The third model, which is what we proposed, it's actually a more intuitive and simpler extension of the finite mixture model, but it actually achieves some of the effects of the coalescent process, as you will see. So we want to assume the following. Again, we have observed n genotypes from n individual, and we assume that each of them is inherited from, coming from a individual haplotype. And then we take a one-layer ancestral assumption, assuming that this modern haplotype is derived from some founder over there through some mutational process. This is just a one-step mutation given the probability of swapping a sign, the bit of a particular site. Okay, so this is a generative model based on one layer of ancestry and descendant information. So therefore, we can see that the approximation to the coalescent, there isn't actually a tree hanging off the ancestor. But then there are some issues we want to address more seriously, such as how do we want to model the ancestors? It turns out that this model is limited if you want to assume you have only a finite number of ancestors, because you don't actually know the number of ancestors. So making them into a finite mixture model doesn't give you the flexibility you want to model arbitrary type of populations. Therefore, ideally, we want to assume a prior distribution over the open space of ancestors, where arbitrary number of ancestors can be allowed. Therefore, I put an infinity sign here to indicate the desired prior distribution of that type.
So, if you had a coalescent model, you have one ancestor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're allowing for one step more ancestors in this group.
In a sense, yeah.
But the real coalescent model has one ancestor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although if I go that far, then you're going to lose a lot by approximating everything is a single set mutation from that one ancestor. Right. So as you will see,
that'd be the real sort of process. You would really have one ancestor somewhere.
Yeah, so you can actually, as I show later, you can actually view this process as some sort of approximation where you have these full trees, but you cut it somewhere in the middle, and then you replace the subtrace with a star genealogy.
I'm just slightly worried about not going back to the original idea, but apparently.
Okay, but I can certainly see you got worried, but let me go on a few more slices. You will see that the distribution actually somehow resembles what people do with the urine sampling formula distribution. Okay, so we want to have a non-parametric hierarchical Bayesian formalism where we define a prior over here which allow arbitrary number of ancestors. And how do we do that? So let me first spend a few slides to talk about the statistical framework, and then let's see what do we actually mean by using that model. So looking at this problem, which is about how to assign modern haplotypes to some unknown ancestors, is very similar to what people do in the pattern recognition community about clustering. We are clustering individuals around centroids. Okay, and the clustering can be also understood as finding a appropriate partition over the distributional space. Right? And how to define a prior distribution over partitions? Well, there is this formalism which has been studied quite thoroughly in the statistical community, known as the Dirich process. The Dirich process is a model which defines distribution over random partitions. Say I have a partition here, which divides the whole probability space into some finite number of sets. And each of them can be described by, say, a centroid, which is the center of data points. And you can also have another partition like this. And this random partition can be captured or described by a distribution if they behave in a certain way. So under the assumption of a Dirich process, a random partition follows a distribution of Dirich process if the weight of each partite can be lined together as a vector and follow a finite dimensional Dirichlet distribution. And the parameters of the Dirichlet distribution of the Dirich prior is defined by a base measure and a scaling parameter known as alpha. This base measure is used to generate a prior mass of the centers located in each partite. And the scaling parameter is a concentrational parameter to tell how divergent the cluster can be, as you will see later. Okay.
Are there really two dimensions in this?
What's that?
Are there two dimensions in this, or is it just one?
What do you mean two dimensions?
Initially, it was just when you had a set of variables that answer to one, like a one dimension.
Oh, yeah, so it's a one dimensional summation at this point.
So, what are the two dimensions on your diagram?
Oh, here, I'm just showing you, an example about how to divide a probably space. Okay. The distribution can be any space. Here, you can see here, the weight is a scalar, therefore it is following a m-dimensional Dirich distribution. Here, I'm talking about the probability mass in each of the partite. It could be any dimensional.
So, so
what he's saying is that this is a Poisson Dirichlet process. Mm-hmm. So if you think of the points of the Poisson Dirichlet process, this is a Poisson Dirichlet measure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a measure associated with
yeah.
it. Well, so the positions are random as well as the actual points. And the positions are giving you this partition of the files.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's this sort of random measure.
Yeah. Each of these is a random measure associated with a subspace in the distributional space. Here, I'm using just this graph to illustrate that phenomenon. It doesn't mean a division of the two-dimensional space. Okay. Or maybe this one is a possible world of divisions. You can see it's a possible world of anything. Okay, so this definition is a little bit abstract, but let's go on with another definition which could be a little bit more intuitive. So what's core in the Dirich process is basically a partition over a random space. And so there are other ways to generate a partition. For example, here is a Poiré-Urn scheme where I want to assign colors to an infinite sequence of balls. And one way to assign them is to follow this Poiré-Urn process, which says that you start with empty urn, and you start by randomly choose a color, say red, and place them into the urn. And then you get an uncolored ball. You're going to assign a color to this ball. What you do is that you draw a sample from the urn and see what color it is, and then assign the same color to this new ball to be given a color. Or with some smaller probability, you again draw from some prior distribution of the color a new color to assign to it. The color are continuously distributed, so whenever you draw from the prior, you are going to get a new color. Okay. And you can imagine that after a few rounds of processes, there will be some ball already in the urn. And now when you draw a new color, they will have a probability of the number of defined by the number of balls in that color divided by the total number of balls in the urn, and plus some residual probability of assigning a new color.
So, this is Hopper's model.
Yeah, it is Hopper's model. Yeah. It's actually the same thing almost.
Okay.
Yeah. And then this is basically going to give you a random partition of the sequence of balls in terms of their color. Okay. And it turns out that this partition is equivalent to the partition produced by the Dirichlet process. Okay, so here is basically what I write down as the joint distribution of the color assignment, which follows a GP. But due to the description of the Poiré-Urn scheme I just described, you can actually now write down a very convenient conditional distribution of the color for each of the ball, given the balls you already assigned a color to, okay, which is described by these two events. One is the event of drawing a ball from the urn and the color accordingly, and the other is a residual probability of drawing a color from a new from the prior distribution and assign a new color to this ball. Okay, so how, why this distribution is interesting? Well, first of all, this is a very handy distribution to allow you create a measure or a distribution over infinite partitions, because here, you know, I can go on and on with the process without predefining the number of colors I need to use to color the balls. Therefore, you know, if you view the coloring of the ball as a clustering effect of the ball, then you actually are clustering without pre-specifying the number of clusters. And secondly, there is a nice phenomenon called a self-reinforcing property, which says that those colors which are better represented in the ball, in the urn, are going to be reused more often. Okay, so there is a concentration effect to avoid creating too many outlier small clusters. And also, this model is an exchangeable model. The partitions are exchangeable, even though the scheme I described just now looks like a sequential process that depends on the order of the ball. Okay, because, you know, one can prove that the joint distribution of the coloring is defined by a division process. And due to the definitive theorem, they give you a central partition. Okay, now I had the model. And how we connect this model to the genetic problems we are interested in? Well, I can now give meanings to each of the colors in here. For example, I can call a color to be a surrogate of an ancestor configurations of the founder. Okay, say here I have one of the haplotype ancestor associated with its unique mutation rate, and this color corresponds to a second ancestor and its unique mutation rate. Therefore, by visiting the haplotype of modern individual and following this division process or the Poiseuille-Urn model, I can now impute new founding ancestors in the model to explain the data without actually specifying how many ancestors I have to use. Okay, clear so far with the description of the model, with the layout of the model. I hope it convinces you that by putting things together back, what I essentially have is actually a pretty simple hierarchical Bayesian model where I have a full generative processes starting from a prior distribution of the ancestors defined by a DP. And from the DP, you can draw ancestors. And from the ancestors, you can now draw the modern individual haplotypes. And then from the haplotypes, you can now sample the observed haplotypes, genotypes. And this is a full generative process. And once you are clear about that, you can now write down a joint probability to describe all this event and then start doing inference backward.
So this is actually a prior on the haplotypes, on the, it really should be a prior on the allele type, but it's a prior on the haplotypes you made it, so you're not taking into account the fine structure, or are you taking into account the fine structure of the ancestors in this? So you're making it, this is a distribution of alleles actually, if you ignore that,
well,
the structure in the actual DNA.
Right.
So you sort of take it as a first go.
Right. So I skipped some details. This is a structure. This is a prior over not a single allele. It is a structure over the haplotype. And I assume that there is no recombination taking place in this region.
But it doesn't take account of the sort of fine structure of the ancestors.
No, it doesn't at this point. And there will be, in fact, this is just the layout of the basic building block, and in my second model, you will see fine structures on that. Okay, this is for actually an easy understanding. Actually, it also mimics a realistic practice people do. So when people do haplotype inference, for example, what they do, at least historically, is to chop them into small regions and assume that there are no structure within the region, and then type each of them. And then you stitch them together using a partition recognition scheme. And this model actually could be used as a submodule to implement that process. But of course, there will be as I go on, a slightly more elegant model on top of this.
Yep. There's no time, no, I guess you're about to show a coalescence, like what is the role of coalescence?
Yeah, I'm going to actually describe a little bit to what do we mean, where do we say coalescence in here, okay.
And so ancestors don't have ancestors, there's only one layer of clustering.
Yeah, there is only one layer of clustering, and that's basically the cost we pay to make the inference easier, because now you really have, you know, a infinite mixture model, and the prior distribution of the mixture component can be also taken care of by the prior Ernst scheme. Therefore, the whole inference become a lot simpler than sum over all possible coalescent tree topologies. Okay.
Is this sort of in some way better than the PAC model, because you've got a sort of another layer?
Yeah, there is a explicit layer of the ancestry. That's actually one of the arguments we want to make for this model, at least. Right. So what does this mean? Is there any populational genetic basis for this model, for the infinite allele model? Well, I think there is certain connections. One can show that the partition structure produced by the Dirich process as I described is the same as the UN sampling formula, which also defines a exchange partition of individuals. And for example, one of the other way of viewing the UN sampling formula is this Hobbs-Ernst model people described.
Bob talked about that yesterday, actually.
Exactly. Okay, so you probably see the same thing already. So that means that ignoring the detailed topology in the tree, if you look at this bottom layer, you know, your partition of the individual according to their haplotype are actually the same as you would believe from a basic coalescent process with a certain coalescent rate, alpha over 2. And there is actually a connection. The coalescent rate in here is twice the scaling parameters of the Dirich process. So then what's actually the approximation in the Dirich process? One can view the approximation as follows. What you essentially do with the Dirich process is to now take this coalescent tree and then somehow cut it in here. Okay, where do you cut actually depends on how big the scaling parameter is. But once you cut, now you assume the descendants, you know, downward this particular intermediate leaf to be IID, conditionally IID. Therefore, it's approximated by a star genealogy rooted in here. Okay, so that's kind of an approximation to the coalescence we want to use in this particular modeling task, because now, you know, you somehow achieve the effect of a coalescence in terms of the sample partition, but you had a much simpler inference problem. Okay, and now we can now plug in some specific design elements to make the model more realistic, because now the nice thing about that is it is a generative model, and the generative model actually are flexible in terms that you can plug in your favorite conditional distribution to describe certain events taking place. For example, we introduced random variables to represent latent ancestors in a pool of unknown size. And we have also random variables representing the modern haplotypes, and we have random variables representing the genotypes. And notice that this is the only observable random variables, and all the others are hidden. But nevertheless, you can now start drawing connections between these hidden events. Specifically, we introduce some auxiliary random variables, C, which are the indicator functions, saying that if C equals to a certain value, then this guy is derived from a certain individuals in the ancestor pool. And the conditioning on that, you can actually write down a mutation model of your favorite form. And here we use a simple form, which is just a random Bernoulli event. Okay, given the ancestor, you have the probability of assume, you know, either the same haplotype, the same SNP, or the different SNP with certain probability. And if you have a model, you want to model the microsatellite which has more than two events, you can generalize this model a little bit more. And then we also can plug in a noisy observation model to describe the possible discrepancies between this and that due to potential typing error. And here, again, we have a noisy channel model for that, which says that you have a certain probability of C inconsistent genotypes and haplotypes. And this is really to provide a little more flexibility in the model to accommodate unexplainable genotypes if it is rare. And putting everything together, we can now start doing inference because we have now a joint distribution of the entire set of random variables. Some are hidden and some are observed. And we can cyclically visit each of the random variables and draw its value conditioning on its dependent random variables. And this is called a Gibbs sampling procedure. And in fact, most of the Gibbs sampling procedure are pretty straightforward, except one of them, which is a little bit it was a little bit more intention. So this is actually one of the Gibbs sampling step that gives you a proposal distribution of the ancestral assignment given the current assignment of haplotype and the ancestors. And you can see it's very interesting structure. It is defined by a product of two elements. The first one is basically the prior distribution of assigning this guy to the ancestor based on a Poiré-Erme model. That's kind of what we described already. But then it should be also multiplied with another likelihood function to describe if you made assignment, how likely they are going to match. So this is a conditional likelihood of the haplotype given the ancestor. Okay, and these two things together decide how which ancestor you have to assign a given haplotype to. Okay, kind of intuitive. It's a trade-off between the prior and the posterior likelihood. And so we run Gibbs sampling over this, and we did a quick sanity check over some data set and compare that to a finite mixture model with possibly wrongly specified number of ancestors. And you can see that over a number of different data sets, indeed, this DP model is much more flexible and accurate in terms of estimating the haplotypes of each individual. Okay, so this is kind of a proof of concept experiment. It is an unsupervised learning problem, therefore you directly run an on data set. The testing comes as you actually know the haplotypes of the data set. Right. So okay, let me explain the experiment a little bit more. It is very different from the clustering type of experiment where you cluster the data pattern using a mixture model or infinite mixture model, and then you visualize the pattern, say, oh, this is cool, this is cool, and that makes sense, and so on and so forth. In here, you are essentially doing clustering because you are assigning, you are estimating the ancestors, and you are assigning the haplotype to their ancestors. But at the same time, you are also estimating the haplotype itself because your data are actually genotypes, right? And the assumption is that if you make all this assignment more correctly, then you are more likely to derive the correct haplotype. And we actually do know the haplotype of all these individuals. We just hide them away from the model. Okay, and that's kind of a pretty tough sanity check of this model. And we show that it is better than the finite mixture.
And there's no way to post this as some sort of supervised thing where you use those to build a model that predicts haplotype from genotype?
You probably could, but what to supervise? The only thing you supervise is to supervise the learning rate. The coalescent rate. This model is not heavily parameterized, by the way. There are not too many parameters to be supervised. And the model is pre-designed. Again, you don't have a way to supervise that. So it is really just an unsupervised learning algorithm in this case.
How do you know those haplotypes?
How do I know haplotypes? Okay, that's the experiment. You can actually do some sophisticated biological sample collection by separating out the chromosomes and sequence each chromosome individually. Or you can type triplet of individual, type their parents, and then compare a triplet of genotypes. And somehow, because there are internal consistency between your haplotype to one of your parents, there is a way to derive pretty much deterministically the haplotype of the progeny. Okay, then when we do the inference, we throw away the parental information and only type, do haplotype inference on the progeny, although their type are actually known already. Okay. So it's pretty reliable in terms of the ground truth. But now I finished layout the model, let's see a realistic deployment of this model. for a realistic task. The actual haplotype inference task actually is more complicated than I just described because of the populational admixing effect, right? For example, now you collect individual genotypes from a world population, and they can come from any of the continent, and they may have different ancestral history and the frequency and so on and so forth. And so how do we actually do haplotype inference problem under this context? Well, it is actually an open issue. The simplest task of approach would be, let's ignore the populational label and just pull them together and do a inference jointly, right? And that's many people actually did that. Well, this is suboptimal because you essentially didn't make use of useful information. A second straightforward solution to that is to let's make a full use of the labeling, because you know I can, for example, type the Europeans, type the Africans, the Asians separately, using you know separate runs of the haplotype program, and that's good. If you can do that, that's actually going to be a reasonable thing to do. But there are again something missing in this strategy, because these world populations are internally connected. You know, a haplotype used here may be also reused there, but with a different frequency. And what you do here are essentially ignoring that information. And more kind of importantly, what if the populational size are quite small? Say you have 10 individuals in each of the population, and then running a haplotype inference program on a very small population creates a problem, right? So you want to somehow make information to flow across population so that they have a strong statistical power for you to do inference. So ideally, we want to do haplotype inference by what we call a co-clustering scheme, where we solve this full problem together in a coupled fashion by using slightly different model for each continent. So here is a rough scheme I outlined here. Let's still assume that for each genetically homogeneous population, say a European population and African one, we have its own deletion process prior for the ancestry. But since this populational specific deletion processes are not exactly independent of each other, we define another prior over the base measure of these populational specific deletion processes. Okay, and there are statistical issues to be discussed on why the hyper prior should be also a deletion process, but I just want to ignore the issue. There are some subtlety in choosing this prior, mainly due to the fact that a deletion distribution is discrete, therefore you have to go one layer above and choose the same discrete distribution to define the prior.
The hyperprior is on somehow on the parameters of the genes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hyperprior on the alphas.
Oh, okay.
Hyperprior on the random
division
part of it.
Okay, this is the genes. Okay, that's a nice point. This is on the random measure point of the genes.
Yeah.
It's
in the positions.
Exactly. It's the position, not the mass,
of the
prior. And the position, actually, as you point out, correspond to a configuration of an ancestral haplotype. So what this model essentially says is that you want to have a master pool of all the possible types there, and then this pool is going to be subsampled for each of the geographic individual geographic specific subpopulations. And the chances are, because this pool is for all the patterns, therefore they are discrete, therefore you have non-zero probability for different subpopulation to use the same pattern in here. But also they will have some likelihood of using a different type if you actually are doing finite sampling from here to here. Okay. So that creates a very interesting sharing structure, meaning that if you look at the two GDPs here, some of the haplotypes are common, but with different frequency. And some of the haplotypes are unique to an individual population. So that's the effect we want to simulate.
So there's a check that's about the fine detail.
What's that?
I just wondered what sort of priors are you using on the positions, if you like, in the random regions?
What's the hyper prior mean? You mean this one? This one or?
Yeah, maybe it's
two. Okay, so here I have a uniform distribution of all the patterns.
Oh,
yeah, and for the scaling parameter, you may ask, how am I going to choose a scaling parameter? I didn't mention that there is also prior associated risk here, which is a typical thing people, the Bayesian people do. They have a non-informative inverse gamma prior here. And we can empirically show that the outcome is insensitive to the choice of the hyper-hyper parameters in here. Again, it's a pretty empirical justification. We don't really have formal theory for that. And so the design looks complicated, but the inference algorithm is actually quite simple. Okay, so the hierarchical Dirichlet process as described can be understood as a layered hierarchical Poiret urn sample. You now have a, you know, an urn here. You have the first layer urn here, which act as the master urn of the children Dirichlet processes. And here you can see the same, you know, sampling scheme applies to that. And in fact, you can collapse these two together to have a master form of the sampling probability of each new haplotype's conditioning on the master urn at the root level. So I put up some math here, but it's pretty easy to come up with the derivation.
The M's like sort of migration.
The M's,
like migration.
The, well, I don't call them migration, but you can understand that in that way. It's just that the...
It's a change of urn.
It's a, yeah, it's a change of the urn. Yeah. Yeah, J means the J's urn or the J's population. And okay, now we applied this algorithm to, first of all, some simulation data, because we want to, there isn't actually an exact population that follows the distribution we described. So we want to first validate the model based on a controlled experiment. We know that how many ancestors are shared across individual population, how many of them are unique. So the way we simulate is as follows. We have five populations to be simulated with 20 individuals of each population. And they share a part of their ancestry. I believe altogether each population had had five founders. Three of them are shared across all the individuals. And the two of them are unique. If I think that's the... Is that right? No. Two of them are shared across all the individuals, all the individual populations, and three of them are populationally unique. Okay, therefore, altogether, you have 17 founders for the entire pool. And it's a small sequence of length 10 so that we can do experiment quicker. And again, we made two type of experimental comparison. We first simulate an easy data set where the mutation rate between the ancestor and the descendants are small, so that you have less randomness in the data. And here is a comparison of five popular haplotype inference program, including FACE, use the PEC model, and the haplotyper, which is a base version of the finite mixture model, and CHB, which is claimed to be another approximation to the coalescent process, although I didn't study carefully how they approximate that. And here I have two our algorithms. DP is not having the populational layered structure, and HDP is having that. And you can see that we are doing pretty well in here compared to the other models. And the theta equals to 0.05 is a more difficult data set where the mutation rate become higher. Therefore, you see more randomness and inconsistency between the haplotype and the ancestors. And again, you see the same trend. And these are just two data, two error measures. One is on errors per site, and this is errors per individual. They are not exactly generated from HDP, but you can imagine that as a finite version of that. Okay. And one of the interesting utility of this model, as you mentioned, is they have this explicit notion of ancestry. Therefore, you can not only estimate the configurations of the ancestor, but also to estimate the number of such ancestors and the mutation rates. And here I just show you some plots about this data. And for example, here you can see that the estimation of the k, the number of ancestors, peaked at 17, which is around the true number. Okay, so you can actually estimate that if the model is designed based on that. And we can also estimate the theta, which is also pretty accurate.
So, can you estimate the theta?
How do I estimate?
You calculate the expected value of k.
Yeah, you have sample. You just collect sufficient statistic in the sample.
Posterior.
Yeah, the posterior. It's the posterior estimation.
So probability of k.
Yeah.
So you have some prior on k.
Oh, okay. There isn't a specific explicit prior on k. The Dirichlet process itself defines the prior of the k, okay, which is somehow taking the shape of a log n type of asymptotic phenomenon. But you don't write prior over k specifically. Okay, remember this prior earn thing. When you draw a new sample, you actually increment k by 1. So there is an explicit way of defining the prior of k in this Dirichlet process.
So it's the probability of k given some parameters that describe the rate of productions of new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, now I apply them to the new to the real data set, which is the international HubMap database. And here is just a rough comparison of a number of different algorithms on different regions of the haplotype. Again, I want to make clear that this comparison is based on a more or less artificial experiment. We clip the long haplotype sequence into smaller pieces so that we can fairly compare the, you know, the basic performance of the algorithm on the data without worry about recombination rates and other things, because different algorithms have different strategy to treat that part, which makes the comparison unfair. Okay. And at least on the basic side, I think the size of the fragment is around 10 something, and we are doing quite reasonable in here. But just to make the story more complete, we did actually. Okay, so this is. Let me actually talk about this. Let's skip this and just for the interest of time. Oh, I think I missed that. I did actually compare the performance on longer haplotypes. Okay, which is like a thousand SNP long, for example. And there you have to have some other things, because the whole thing is not inherited from a single ancestor. There are interesting recombination events and all that. And some model, such as the fast phase model, use a hidden Markov model to capture recombinations. And Hypertyper use a partition ligation scheme. And I actually also implemented a partition ligation scheme of the HDP. And I didn't show the comparison here, but the performance are comparable now. It's not like we're dominating over the others, but the speed is a lot faster. That's the thing we gain from this model. You can do pretty fast inference. This graph, okay, let me skip this graph and move on to the second one, because I do want to talk about the main thing.
So if you look at, so you showed k's for mm-hmm. the simulated data. Mm-hmm. What did they look like
for
real data, and do you have some interpretation of that?
Okay, so on my tech report in my website, I did show a graph on the notation estimation and the k estimation for the real data. It's hard to explain because, okay, I can give you a kind of outline of the trend. We see a smaller k over the African population, and we saw a bigger k over the Asian population. And we saw a trend like that a little bit, but I don't know how to explain that, because this k, I'm not sure it should be taken seriously, in terms of it actually indicates number of founders. It's kind of a relative number you can tell, but not the absolute number. And also the mutation rate is problematic, because it is confounded also by the time of the divergence, right? So. It's very hard to interpret it as a per-generation mutation rate. Okay, so now I get to the topic about the subject we announced in the talk, which is about recombinational event in this data. So again, as usual, let me first outline how we start formulating this problem and then tell you a possible solution based on the Dirichlet process as described. So how do we model haplotype structure? Here is a display of the haplotypes of a bunch of individuals, and you hardly see any structure in this data, right? But I could do some permutation. First of all, I want to find some boundaries in this block of data by some way, and I'm going to tell you how I'm going to do that. But let's say suppose we can divide the whole data set into these three blocks. Each one corresponds to a small region on the genome with a few haplotypes. And then I permute the column, the rows of this. And then after I randomly permute them, you can probably see that there are a limited amount of diversity within each of the regions in this haplotype. Okay. Which suggests that maybe in this region there are some common ancestry event, and here there are another type of ancestry evolutionary event, but across them there may be some event to join the two events together through a recombination or other events. And it is interesting to actually study this phenomenon for many people, and the problem can be, where shall I find the best place to divide the data, and how much diversity you have within each block, and so on and so forth. One of the models being proposed recently is the following. I start with a guess of the boundary, and then I can now calculate the number of haplotypes within each block, and then I come up with a transition model to define the probability of using one of the pattern in here and connect them to the pattern in here through a transition model. Okay, so for example, here is a transition model. The probability of start with this pattern and followed by that pattern is defined by this probability. And you can just walk over the transition matrix to stitch together a long sequence of haplotypes using this model. And this is really essentially a hidden Markov model. And once you write down the likelihood of the entire observation in a row using this model, you actually have now a likelihood score of the data. And then you can start doing model selection, right? And you can basically say, what's the trade-off between the number of parameters and the likelihood of the data, and so on. And in the end, you can somehow come up with an algorithm to optimize the choice of the boundaries at each position. So that's the current approach people do. And they have been using this to do a recombination hotspot prediction. For example, this boundary can be interpreted as a potential location for recombination to take place. But we want to slightly modify this model, because there are some computational issues involved in here, and also it is a finite model which really ignores the fact that we don't know the number of ancestors and so on and so forth. So we come up with this idea by observing the following event phenomenon. We can easily come up with an inheritance model using a recombinationally motivated transitional event as follows. Suppose that we have a finite number of common ancestors, and to produce an individual chromosome, we, for example, randomly draw a pair of them and sample a place where a recombination should take place and stitch them together. And also, you can imagine that the ancestor could experience a mutational event, therefore there are some sites where you see a different SNP. And after you do these processes on, in the end, you are likely to come up with a data set like this, where each of the individual chromosomes are, first of all, a mosaic of some number of ancestors, and also there are mutations on top of that. So this generative event can be very easily described by a hidden Markov model over a finite dimensional space. First of all, you have a transition matrix describing the probability of one chromosome recombining with the other chromosome at a particular locus. And the transition probability can be defined based on the distances between the pair of locuses through a recombinational probability as a function of the distance. And then again, we can apply the mutation model from the ancestor, or actually this actually produce a recombined founder. And then on top of that, you can again have notations to produce the current haplotypes. And again, you can apply the noisy observation model to describe the event. So here we have a model, you know, starting from recombining ancestors to the observed genotypes, which are hopefully more realistic than the one I just described earlier, where each haplotype are only derived from a single ancestor.
So sorry, so the Markov model for the dynamics of the indicator functions C?
You could think about in that way. The C is basically the choice of ancestors for a particular loci. Okay.
At the time in the Markov model, there's nothing to do with any real time.
This is not a time, this is the partition.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is basically you are working along the chromosome and how far your work defines how likely you are going to recombine. Okay, so this model is kind of clean, but again, we are running into the issue about how many ancestors we need to choose in here because we don't actually know that. And here I'm going to integrate that idea I just described for DP to extend this model to a nonparametric setting. Now let's imagine that we have a pool of unknown number of ancestors. Therefore, this is an open space. And then what we need to do is to define a transition model of these chromosomes over the open space. Okay. That means you need to have an infinite dimensional transition matrix to describe the recombination probability, which is, of course, quite unrealistic. One idea to model this type of distribution is to use the sampling idea, the stochastic process idea I just described for this process. Because when you are doing the inference, you are actually drawing a finite number of samples, which may not necessarily realize all the possible ancestors you have to take care of. They are a finite structure, right? And your goal is to describe the probability of all this finite structure and have a right data structure to maintain that. So here is what I propose. Let's imagine each of the row of the transition probability matrix. So this is basically a probability for one of the chromosomes to meet any other chromosomes in the matrix, in the population. And now I do not know the number of ancestors in here. Therefore, I can describe this row as a division process, which gives you the partition over this open space of ancestors. So that's one DP. Okay. Now I look at the second row. This is the probability of the second chromosome to meet all the other chromosomes. Therefore, it is also a partition over a different partition over the same distributional space. Okay. Therefore, I can have another DP for that. And now you go down the row, and you are going to see a number of such transition probabilities for each of the realized founder chromosomes. And each of them is a DP. But these are the DPs defined on the same set of chromosomes. Okay. Therefore, they are all together tied by the same ancestor pool. Remember the technique I used to describe the hierarchical division processes? I'm going to define a populational specific DP for each population and then tie together with a common prior. And here I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to assume that each row in the transition matrix is going to follow another higher order division prior so that I have a hierarchical division processes. Each of the bottom layer correspond to each of the row in this transition matrix. Okay, so this is a little bit complicated. Any questions before I move on?
Somehow the diagonal elements should be different,
right? Yeah, there are some technicalities to be taken care of in here, but
what's the interpretation of the number of ancestors that you will infer finally from this kind of technique?
The number of ancestors? Well, it is. Statistically, you can understand that as the size of the model. I'm not sure whether there is a specific genetic meaning for that. But you could interpret them as the number of founding chromosomes if you if you want.
Eventually, it must be one, just one.
No, after a finite cut in somewhere. So you can imagine that as a genetic bottleneck, for example. Mm-hmm. Okay, there is a bottleneck where you know population start to explode, but right before that explosion, you see some number of founders. But I kind of, from a statistical point of view, I don't feel comfortable giving them too much genetic interpretations. It's like in the structure, you can choose K anywhere from, 1 to 20 and display beautiful colors, but it's very hard to really interpret what that K mean. Right. Yeah. Okay, so hopefully you can get the high level idea about how this model is designed. It's essentially a hidden Markov model working in infinite dimensional space, which allow arbitrary number of ancestors. And by doing that kind of model design, you now can do some very interesting inference query. So here is another graphical model view of the model. So imagine that I have a founding, I have an individual haplotype, and there is a sequence of indicators associated with each locus. And depending on the value of the indicator, I'm going to draw one of the ancestors to be the founder of this one and realize this one by annotation. And then the choice of the ancestors along the chromosome is going to follow a recombination process as an infinite hidden Markov model. So that's basically the whole design of the model. And then except for, okay, for simplicity, let's assume this is observed. But if you want to work with genotype data, this could be hidden and have one more layer of observation. But these are the true hidden variables. So the indicator function and also the ancestors. And by doing GIP sampling, you can now collect samples based on the posterior distribution of each of these latent variables. And then by collecting the sufficient statistics of all these latent random variables, you can answer a few questions of interest. For example, you can reconstruct the ancestral alleles by, looking at these patterns. And also you can infer the number of a recombination event. For example, if you see the labels between adjacent pairs are different, that means there is a recombination taking place here. And you can count how many such events are happening in your sample, and you can compute the rate of recombination based on this model. And also, you can answer other queries like, what is the genetic structure of a current individual? Here you have, of course, the structure program gives you a reflection of the admixing structure of individual chromosomes. But here you have a more direct way of reflecting that. Here you can see how many seeds are from each of the ancestors, and then give a tally of the whole numbers. And in the end, you can actually see for each of the individual haplotype, how much fraction is coming from one of the chromosomes and so on. And that gives you, as I show later, another type of display of the genetic structure, which is very similar to structure, but they have different interpretations. And inference is standard by doing a GIP sampler, but we do have some design trick to make the whole inference faster using some block GIP sampling ideas and other speed up strategies. Recently, we actually also come up with a beam sampling approach where you can combine a forward-backward algorithm for hidden Markov model inferences with this, but I'm going to skip the details of that. And here is what you're expecting to see. For example, you can collect all the empirical recombination event and plot a histogram of the recombination rates. And it turns out that we see two peaks in the recombination frequencies. And that basically suggests there are some hotspot recombination rates and some baseline recombination rates, and by finding an intersection in the middle, we have now a threshold for detecting recombination hotspots. And then we can apply the threshold to the real data and start, identifying where such hotspots are on the DNA sequences. And here,
The data on the left comes out of the inference?
The data on the left? Yeah, this is coming from the GIP sampler.
Yes.
Yeah. So here is a real data set we used, again, from the HubMap data. And what is showing here is the LD map of the individual. You compare pairwise correlations or linkages of all the markers. And obviously, they will show you some block structure indicating possible LD patterns. And these are the inferred recombination hotspots from our program. And here is the inferred structure from another standard program called LD-HAT. And well, if you see the comparison of these two, they find some common peaks. But they could be very different in other places. It is very hard for me to tell which one is more correct. Therefore, I did a very simple and small simulation. We just simulate from the hidden marker model recombination events and the hotspots, and then let both programs to run on the simulation data to detect the recombination hotspots. And the comparison seems to suggest that the spectrum program, which is based on our model, is doing quite nicely, slightly outperforming the LD-HAT algorithm.
I'm not sure how to remember the upper left figure. I think of LD as a correlation, so I would expect it to be a symmetric
thing. This one? Sorry, I used two scores. This is one type of LD score. This is another LD score.
So the lower left is you and the upper right is somebody else?
It should be a symmetric event. Therefore, I save the space to display some other metric, okay, over the association.
Okay, so it's two different definitions of
that. Yeah, yeah. And there are, you can come up with another one, third one, fourth one. There are many things like that. Okay. But basically, they give you kind of the same structure. And you can see the block like this.
Yeah. So your eye can pick out block structures,
mm-hmm.
the LD pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You have your highest hotspot within one of those.
Yeah, I have not only the height of the spots, but also there are some detailed patterns, not only based on the pairwise correlation. So this computation is really based on all pairwise correlations. It is not explicitly modeling, you know, spatial structures along the chromosome. Right? And here, you know, it is a model-based inference, therefore more information incorporated. Therefore, it's more sensitive to, low LDs in a sense, such as like a peak in here or a peak in here are not quite obvious.
So it's, the implication would be that it's actually wrong for people just to look at those LD patterns by eye and guess where the two combinations are.
I would lean toward interpreting like that. But this map has been used in a very classical study, but even now, people want them to have a low-level global picture rather than seriously detecting, you know, every recombinant hotspots, I guess.
Did you look at your predictions for the HLA region where there are?
Yeah, I haven't done that yet. So when this study was conducted, I wasn't very experienced or informed about all this standard way of testing. So now we are actually moving toward that.
So is uniform recombination a sort of set of your program? Like, I mean, if the data was being uniformly recombined, would you see that?
Okay, yeah. That's a good thing. As of now, in the model, we didn't incorporate explicitly. But in the inference, you could see that because, you know, we did come up with empirically two estimations of the recombination rate. I would interpret this as the baseline uniform recombination rate. You will see all over the place. So what happens is that you now see, you know, you can now estimate the recombination event from many individuals, and for each individual, for each locus, you can now compute a local recombination rate, right? And then here is a histogram of such recombination rate over all the sites, and you can see that some sites are falling in here and some sites are falling in here, which kind of suggests two types of recombination events. But we are trying to come up with an extension of the model where you can explicitly encode two different recombination events, which is not difficult. You can make the hidden marker model state space to be twice as big. Somehow the student got bored with this model and she thought there isn't enough statistical incentive to develop that, although I'm trying to push her to code it up to tell a more complete genetic story. Okay, so there are some recent developments where we also integrate these approaches to the genome type association mapping, where the block structure can be used to have a better prediction of the causal SNPs. I don't have time to talk about the whole idea, but here is the rough picture. So suppose that you are not connecting your genotype data with phenotypic observations, and you assume that there is a linear model to generate the response from the predictor. And now, when people do this kind of association analysis, they do two things. Most people do pairwise association test, and then do a permutational test and find a threshold, and then cut there and find a lot of good signals in the genome, and call them either causal SNPs or QTRs or things like that. Some other people can do a more sophisticated approach using a regularized linear regression, okay, such as Lasso, to find an estimate of the beta under this function. And there are different ways of regularizing the beta to make them as sparse as possible. But still, when you are giving very high dimensional data, say a billion dimension, that model fails because theoretical analysis suggests that the Lasso approach or the L1 regularized regression only work asymptotically correctly if the predictors are independent of each other. And if you connections of them, then they can pick just some of them or miss some of them. So the HMM idea I just talked about actually can be applied in here to come up with a better regularization scheme by introducing, on top of each regularization coefficient, a indicator function to indicate whether this particular feature or indicator is on or off in predicting the response. And that again defines a joint probability model, and you can do inferences. And in the end, we see
the X's are all binary.
What's that?
The X's are all binary, is that right?
The X's are binary, this one. What do you mean by X's are binary?
X of ij is gone from what space?
Oh, okay, that's irrelevant. Yeah, so, okay, sure. In here, I've been quite general. You could have continuous features, continuous input. I'm just defining a regression problem.
But in the data that you're about to show us, it's SNPs, so the X's are...
It's just genotypes this time. So therefore, it's a 0, 1, and 2, however you represent that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the observation could be, again, continuous or discrete. Yeah. But here, I guess there are various ways of engineering this and that. What we worry about is how to regularize this beta in a block fashion. I want the beta to be not only sparse but also blocky, so that you have the LD structure explicitly taken care of. And here is just a rough display of a very early result, which is still under update. So here is the result of independent Bernoulli prior and the independent test. You can see that there are a lot of good signals to be picked up. It's too much. Lasso reduced the amount of signal a little bit, but still have a lot of signals. And this is the regularized, the block regularized regression. You're now seeing a bigger, much cleanup of the predictors. And then you see, you know, I don't see a lot of blocky phenomenon, but at least the regularization now works stronger. And maybe there are some blocky event in here. Or at least I see blocky in the suppression of the markers. If you suppress the first marker, the second marker should be also suppressed. That's kind of the blocky phenomenon here. Okay, so I think I'm severely over time. Should I go on with the third part of the talk?
You know, why don't we take a break for 10 minutes or something, and then come back.
I'm going to be faster for the rest of the talk. This is actually a pretty easy thing. You probably already heard about 100 times already. It's going to be a little very tiny idea on top of a very successful existing idea. So hopefully I won't spend too much time to explain the incentive and the motivation and so on and so forth. So people see this map on in many places. It's a product of what we know as the admixture model. In machine learning, people call it mixed membership model, or there are some other names. Basically, you're producing a spectrum of different contributions from some funding structure, which I'm going to explain. But look at this display of the human populational structure. I can assume there are two funding patterns, three funding patterns, and five, and so on, and then plot the fraction of contribution of each of the funding pattern in each individual. And then I'm going to just to blow up each of the line. Each of the line here is actually look like this. It's of length one, and the fraction, the length of the fraction is the probability of contribution from each of the funders. And then you order them according to the populational label, and then you're going to see some structure which are claimed to be reflecting the genetic demography or structure from world population. For example, here there are African populations on this side, European ones, Asian ones, and so on. And you can probably see that indeed geographically different populations do have very distinct genetic structure, at least reflecting from this side. But I think the function, the utility of this program stops here. You can tell that populations are different. But I feel you cannot go further by saying why they're different and what does this difference mean. For example, in here, the picture in here reflecting sort of the phenomenon that this African population are coming from its unique founder, and the European ones coming from a second founder, and there are no overlap between these two. That's kind of what's suggested in this picture. And genetically, it doesn't make a lot of sense, except in telling that these two populations are different. So I'm going to try to modify that program a little bit in order to tell a slightly richer story.
Is that sequence
data
or is it
microsatellite? This is microsatellite data. I'm going to actually exactly explain the data on this side. So the polymorphic data used for this analysis are typically called the microsatellite data, or the variable number of tandem repeats. They are another type of polymorphism which is defined on the number of copies of some repetitious unit in the DNA. And there are standard ways of read off such informations, which I'm not going to explain. But in the end, you can understand the data as the position of the peaks out of some electrophoresis experiment. And the peaks, the location of the peaks actually indicates the number of copies of the repetitious unit. In here, I have a standard letter to indicate 12 copies, 13 copies, 14 copies, and then you sample an individual, and then you will read a pair of peaks of him and decide where it is. So that's the data collection. And so where does the pattern come from in the picture I just showed? So this program is called a Structure 2.1. And I think it's still being updated by Jonathan, which is based on this model. You represent each individual as a vector of probabilities, and each of them represents the probability of drawing samples from a founding pool of alleles. Okay, this pool, say the red founder has is represented by a vector of probabilities of the probability of each allele in this founding pool. And the same allele set may have a different frequency of another in another founder population or in a third founder population. And then the way to generate an existing genotype or polymorphism is by first decide which pool to sample from. Okay, so you have, for example, 90% probability of using this pool, 2% probability of using this pool, then you are going to log into that pool. And then once you are in this founder pool, you are going to draw one of the alleles with probability defined by the allele frequency unique to this population. Okay, and once you run this sampler, by the way, this is just the founder for one allele at a particular position, and imagine that your DNA has a whole array of sites, and then for each other site you just define this, and then you are going to produce a human, a modern polymorphism of multiple sites. Okay. So that's basically called an admixture model. It is saying that each individual are built upon multiple mixtures. And one of the key property that we need to be a little bit careful about is that in here, there is no distinction between the alleles you observed in a modern individual and the alleles you assume to be exist in the founder allele and founder population. So therefore, it's an exact copy of the founding allele to the current one with no change. And it does not model mutations or recombinations in a formal sense. There is an event, a process called recombination described in the paper, but that recombination was not on chromosome level. It's a recombination between these populations. Okay, as a result, you can write down the likelihood of the data and start doing inference and estimation. And what is shown in this graph are the estimation of the frequency of resorting to each of the founding populations. Okay, here is a graphical model representation of what I just described. Okay, here is the observed allele of a microsatellite marker. And here is the indicator function of which population it is coming from. And this theta is the frequency of using different founding population. And here I have for each founding population a pool of allele frequencies. And what will happen is that you first draw based on a prior a vector of populational frequency, and then you decide for each of the marker which founder population to use, and then pull a marker directly from here to here. Okay, it's a pretty simple model.
The allele frequencies are the actual observed ones.
The allele frequency is also not observed. Everything is estimated. So here you have beta to be defined as unknown frequencies. Okay. And for smoothness purpose, people also define priors on top of that, such as a Dirichlet prior. Okay, so that's the model. It's been actually widely used not only in genetics but also in social science and in machine learning, document modeling and all that. And one can replace this number with word frequencies, other observational network linkages and all that. So there is a whole area in statistics and machine learning working with this model. But the key issue I want to attack in this model is that I didn't like the fact that this and that is the same. There is no mutational process between the current and the founding alleles. So here is a model I propose. Again, you have a bunch of founding populations, but now I want to represent each of the founding population with a slightly enriched representation. Okay, so each founding population is going to be described as a mixture model where you have the frequency of mixture components, meaning the frequency of the allele as we had in this model, but also the allele themselves, okay, associated with perhaps an allele-specific mutation rates. Therefore, whenever you want to produce a observed genotype, a polymorphic marker in a modern population, you are going to first draw a indicator about which ancestor population to use. And then once you are in that ancestor population, you need to draw a second indicator based on this allele frequency vector about which allele to use. And once you are decided which allele to use, you are going to zoom into that allele and produce based on the founding allele a mutation to arrive at an existing allele. Okay, see that model? The differences between this one and that one? The only step is that there is an ambiguity between the actual allele you inherited and the observed allele. And here there is no ambiguity. Okay, once you are in there, you pretty much know where you are inheriting from.
So counting the number of diamonds helps us count the number of free parameters.
What's that?
If I count the number of diamonds, then I get ultimately the number of ultimately free parameters.
I don't quite understand your analogy.
Alpha, lambda, and capital delta are things that are going to be sort of free parameters.
Alpha, lambda, and delta, they are free parameters.
They will ultimately be the parameters of the model.
Yes.
So later when you quote the probability of K or something, I think there's probability of K given alpha comma.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Right, so that's basically a simple fix of the existing model. So that the benefit what you get is you can now get, you know, the rate of mutations of on top of each allele with respect to their founder, and also the founder themselves. And as this model, you can also estimate the frequency of populational inheritance. So I call this model now a population-specific mixture of inheritance models, rather than a populational-specific profile of allele frequencies. Because in here, you are going to actually realize the inheritance process from a founding allele to an existing allele through a mutation model. And the mutation model can be designed by user based on our knowledge in the literature. For example, here, I use a stepwise model to describe the microsatellite type mutation. And I can use a Bernoulli model to describe the SNP mutation rate. And what happened in the real operation of this model is that suppose you observe an allele like 15.1, and then you observe allele 15.2, and then you observe some allele 15.16, for example. Based on this model, you are going to have three founders because they are all distinct. And in this model, you might end up with just two founders, because these two are very similar. It may be coming from the same ancestor just through a slightly different mutation process. Okay. And the inference on this model is quite complicated, as we had for the admixture model. It involves some non-trivial integration and summation over a high-dimensional space. But again, we can have, you know, very established method of dealing with this problem. Here is the rough idea. You approximate a true distribution of the hidden random variables with a easier distribution, which is called a variational approximation, and then you try to minimize the KL divergence between the true distribution and the approximate distribution, and then in the end gives you a fixed point iterational scheme for the inference. This is very similar to the Gibbs sampling scheme used in Jonathan's paper, except that this is faster, but it is it's less accurate as a cost of the speed up. So I'm mainly going to show you some results about this model, because it's really a simple design. The first result is again based on simulation, and I want to see how accurate this model can recover the admixing vector, the theta vector. Here is a rough display of the outcome on one sample. So here is the collection of theta vector over 100 simulated individuals. Okay, and this is what we inferred based on our model called M structure, stands for mutational structure. And this is a result based on structure, which is not having the mutation. It's very hard to see the difference based on a single example. So we did a repetition of this experiment and systematically study the differences between the estimate and the truth. And here is a comparison. We simulated data based on a number of free knobs in the model to make the problem behave interestingly. For example, here I have the Dirichlet prior alpha to vary from 0.1 to 0.2, 0.5 to 2. The bigger the value, the more skewed, okay, that theta will be. Okay, if you remember that this is defining a prior of the multinomial distribution. And I compare M structure and structure. You can see that we are always making less error, okay, compared to the structure. And here, okay, this is a setting where we change the separation between the founding alleles. How different founding alleles will be. You can imagine that the bigger separation, the problem will be easier. And it turns out that our methods are insensitive to the change of the separation, at least in this range. And the structure are doing altogether worse than that, than our model. And this is another scenario where we change the mutation rate from the ancestor to the existing alleles. And the bigger the mutation rate, the more difficult the problem will be. And you can see that, again, our algorithms are kind of stable with different mutation rate. And this one goes up quickly. Why is that? Because if you have more mutation rate, you are going to generate more confounding factors between the existing alleles. They may mistakenly be interpreted as two different founders in the ancestry, which may not be true. Okay, so that's a simulational comparison. Now here is the real comparison on the famous map produced by Stretcher on their science paper. I believe here I used k equal to, by the way, there is an issue about how many k to choose, how many founding ancestors, founding ancestor population to be used. One could also use the division process idea I just talked about to make them infinite. But here I just want to make the story simple to align our model exactly with the structure model by choosing a finite number of k. I think k here is equal to 5. And I run the two algorithms on the same data set and want to compare them side by side in the same format. And you can see an interesting phenomenon. So first of all, I think both of these algorithms are equally well capable of telling apart different geographic populations. You see the right boundary in here, and in here. And we also have the right boundary, although the definition of the boundary is different. But then looking into the representation of each individual, it's very interesting. Here we can see that the structure like to define the African population as coming from a unique founding population. They basically set aside a founder that consumes all the internal genomic complexity within that prior distribution, and then you're going to keep using that. And then for the European ones, you have a different founder population, and just this is a convenient model because now you avoid any sharing between these two because they are so different. But on the other hand, other than separating the population, you lose kind of the genetic insight about how these two might be connected. And the similar effect comes from here. In here, we kind of see a very different representation of the of different geographic populations. First of all, notice that there is a magenta element across all the population, seemingly suggests that there is actually a potential common founding population that is going to be reused with different proportion among different geographic population. And then there are different amount of admixing of other elements in different world populations, which is again interesting to interpret. But I didn't find a way to give a better interpretation of that. But it's hard for me to tell which model is correct because they do look different, and they achieve the same property of a separating population. But which representation is better is debatable. Right. So then I show you something else to see, maybe you can tell me which representation is better. So note that this graph can be also viewed as a dimensional reduction of the original data. Right. You have the input data, which is a long vector of haplotype configurations, microsatellite configurations. It could be a 100-dimensional vector. And then now you reduce them to the theta, which is the admixing frequency based on a finite number of founding populations. And people can build a phylogeny based on the original data, but they can also build a phylogeny based on this data by using each of the column as a leaf representation in this tree. And here is a phylogeny we built on top of this representation derived by the M structure. And we see, let me highlight some of the structure in this phylogeny. It's just a standard tree building phylogeny. I borrowed from Philip program. So we see a block of African here, which is expected. They diverged first. And then I saw a clade of Europeans, the Indian Americans, and the Asians. And the Indian Americans and Asians seems to be divergent after the Europeans and Asians are divergent. Okay. So this is what we see here. Then using this one as representation, we can also build a tree. And that's the tree we saw. We see a tree like this. Here, I also want to highlight a few structures, and I don't know whether it makes more sense or less sense. First of all, the African population somehow gets less clustered in the tree. But more interesting, I see a different divergent event of the remaining three populations. I saw the Indian Americans to be coming out first before the Asians and the Europeans are divergent. So I don't know which, I know both hypotheses exist in the literature. Some people believe this is true. This, but at least these two programs does tell a conflicting story, and I'm not sure which one is more plausible.
I think the idea of trying to represent human populations on a branching tree is something that most people want to get away from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So that I wouldn't say that this one proves or disproves the other method, but at least this is a way to visualize the outcome of the similarities between population and within population, at least. Okay. And then there are some other things to visualize based on our program. Remember that in our program, we do have a capability of estimating the mutation rates, okay, of the current allele with respect to their founding alleles. And you can actually now plot the estimation of the mutation rates on the world map based on where the samples are collected. And here is a plot we obtained based on our data. And the darker color, a warm color, means higher mutation rates.
Is this actually mutation rate or number of mutations?
The rate. It's just a number. Yeah. And seems to be also interesting, at least intuitive. You have the highest mutation rate in here, and also there is a local peak in here, and then there are lighter colors along this line and that line. At least I thought this information interesting because in structure there is no way to infer information like this.
But I think that, mm-hmm. that is very surprising. I would not expect mutation rates to vary in one part of the world.
Oh, okay. So I think this suggests the age of the founders, the divergent time. Right? See here, it means that your allele are further apart from the founders. And here, the alleles are less apart from the founders, meaning that they diverge later.
It's integrating across time.
It's not the rate. It's a number of mutations or something like that.
Oh, it's based on definitions in our model, we define them as somehow reflect the probability of having a mutation from the founder to the.
But that's because there's only one step anyway. Right?
Yeah.
So that's right. If you have more mutations within that step, in reality, that means that.
So I'm not really capturing the details of the actual process of mutation, but here you have a surrogate of the amount of differences between founders and the descendants. And I think this picture just simply want to claim that this one diverged greater than that.
Kind of an implied mutation rate.
Yeah, and there.
Mutation rate.
Not really, it is in this model.
Yeah, so again, as I said, I'm not a geneticist, so I'm using this in a more statistical sense, the probability of having a difference, in a sense.
Do you get the same numbers, or do you get different numbers for different parts of the
There's not a time. Time is always one.
No, this is a tree, so this is a tree.
I'm using the confounding thing. It is the per generation between rate times the time already, because here, remember the model defines, use this number to define the probability of the current allele given the founding allele. So it's everything has been taken care of already, the time and also the rate. So maybe it's incorrect to say the mutation rate. It is really the total amount of difference. Okay, and at least from a, I would expect to see this. If I see a peak in here, I will be surprised. And then, what's that?
Southern Portugal. I'm not a geneticist, so I have no idea what this.
I think Portugal is quite enigmatic.
Yeah. And by the way, the sample is pretty sparse. Yeah, well, I wouldn't really read this too carefully rather than the overall global trend, right? The trend is that you are going from here outward, which is roughly the all of Africa, rather than out of, say, China or out of North America. Okay. So I think at that level, it is making sense.
So how would this relate to a simple measure like diversity?
Good question. I haven't really did that.
Because that diversity shows essentially this.
Mm-hmm. Possible. I didn't really look at that. Yeah. And here is one more graph showing you something. You know, like there's a center of gravity in here, and I know there are some other studies saying that Yunnan province is kind of where the Chinese population was originally established, and something here. Yeah. So I'm not trying to tell there is a additional thing or something original reflecting this data, but I'm saying that by just slightly modifying that existing model, you get these additional results which may be interesting to interpret. And I believe that the original model has a problem just by intuition, because there isn't any way to model the differences between the current allele and the founding allele, and that's an important element affecting the populational structure. Okay. So that's it. This is just the. Oh, by the way, okay, I guess you can do the same thing of populational plotting by using our hidden Markov model for recombination, just by plotting these contributions on the chromosomal level as a vector, and again that produces you a different map. And I haven't really go very deep into how to interpret this map yet, but they certainly also look very different. Again, they reflect you the amount of diversity within each population, which is not possible in the structure program. So what I interpreted from the structure program is that somehow they find a model which separates different populations, but they don't actually intend to carefully model what is within each population. Somehow it is being taken care of in this part, which is not visualizable. Okay. And in here, I have a more explicit representation of the degree of diversity within each population and within each individual. And it's kind of interesting to reflect, to at least study these two kinds of representations of human genetic structure. That's it, and I may be interested in combining these two approaches to plot a two-dimensional representation of human structure. One is on a populational admixing level, the other is the chromosomal admixing level, but I haven't done that yet, which is potentially our future task. Okay, I think that's the end of the presentation. Before we finish, I want to acknowledge my graduate student and postdocs for working out many of the important implementations and experiments, and the funding agencies for paying the research effort. Okay, thank you.
So you mentioned briefly that you could, that you're running this MSTRUP with a fixed K right now, but you could go to the year.
I could, yeah.
I'm not sure what to expect there. Would you expect to just settle on some value K that sort of dominates?
There is a program called Structurama by a group in SD, I think, people already implemented the deletion process version of the structure. I think, I think there will be a peak that you find the optimal number of k. But again, the interpretation is, it depends on the utility. I think most people use this program to display the structure. The way I know people use it is that they try a different number of k's and then feel this picture is prettier and more intuitive. I said on that. So I don't really see a good amount of demand in estimating k seriously. But we can do that, of course, using that model.
A related question is on slide 30.
Okay.
Were you comparing
the third? 30.
Maybe I can ask you about that.
That's not okay. What that slide was about?
So that was a slide where you compared, as you put it, DP versus EM, meaning
duration. Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
Process versus mm-hmm. EM, which I'm guessing stands for expectation maximization.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there you were comparing one model mm-hmm. with an inference algorithm. So I think that's what you mean is there's a fixed value of K, but you solve it versus expectation maximization.
Yeah.
So DP, you use Gibbs sampling.
Yes.
So several times in this talk, you use Gibbs sampling, and then at some point you said, here we use variational methods. So can you give us some sense for when we should use Gibbs?
Oh, okay. So sorry for the confusion. When I compare the DP with the EM algorithm, I'm actually comparing two models.
Yeah,
okay.
Agreed.
Yeah. And,
so it's a little bit of a confounding thing. So
yeah.
You've got a model one with variational method one.
The variational thing, the variational inference is a different model. It's completely, I also implemented the Dirich processes, the Gibbs sampling for the structure program, for the M structure.
And it's still
useful. You know, if you are a patient, you can wait long, they give you the same thing.
So my question is, when do we use variational methods and when do you use
it? Oh, okay. Fair enough. That's a good question. When do you use variational? If you want to have a very quick, dirty solution to an inference problem, you always want to use variational inferences. But the variational inferences are best, are easy to implement when you have a finite model. Okay, if you have an infinite model, there is no variational approximation exist. So I have to use the Gibbs sampler. So remember, in the third part of the talk, I do have a finite model. That's where I switch to the variational inferences. But that's not really a big deal. I mean, only computer scientists worry about the inference issues. I think statisticians always do the Gibbs sampling, which is fine. I mean, I think that method is also okay in this approach. Yeah. The main point on the third one is really there is a little extension on the model side. I play down the inference innovations over there.
As long as you pull up your slides, can we go to slide 25?
Yeah.
25. Okay, so you didn't. It wasn't 25. Sorry, can we go back one slide? 24, I guess.
This one.
I obviously wrote it down. So there was some slide that at the bottom had the sentence coalescent arrow the Richley process.
Oh yeah, that's.
You didn't actually say the phrase out loud.
So I'm arguing that
inference requires you to simulate MCMC over trees, and the DPM, which is something that you can some pencil and paper.
Okay, so there are some jargons I didn't explain carefully enough. Infinite mixture model is a DPM mixture model.
Agreed.
Okay, that's the same thing. And then I'm saying that this infinite mixture model can be understood as a bunch of star genealogy in a genetic sense. You have a known number of star genealogy, and the conditioning on the ancestor here, everything in the descendants are independent of each other, which is exactly the definition of an infinite mixture model.
So when you say can be understood as, you do not mean can be derived from.
Yeah, these three things are the same.
Agreed.
It's just a different view of the same thing.
Completely agreed.
Right.
And then in the upper left, there's a thing which you cannot.
And then from here to here, that's basically an approximation I introduced.
on pencil and paper, or you mean we should? I want to understand how rigorous this approx is.
How rigorous the approximation is?
Derive star genealogies from coalescence, or this is a conceptual?
It's a conceptual thing, I think.
So it's the,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I understand how this model on the lower right, which you can do inference with, you have some pencil.
I believe a closed form derivation is autopolar. I didn't do that. I didn't do the derivation, but I think it's easier to view it conceptually because you know it is many of the literature in the coalescent process actually studied this, right? For example, the branches of the coalescent tree are pretty low in the tree. Therefore, you know, you don't lose much by choosing different places in cutting the tree. But then all these subtrees has a dense topology with many little branches, which doesn't really change the conditional distribution too much if you just approximate with a star.
That would be useful to understand how these different models
are interacting. Yeah, I think you have a paper write up, I think, on the whole theory of coalescence there. I learned that from there as well.
So I just want to finish saying, Eric's worked on a number of other problems in biology and in evolution, and one of them is on related to gene regulation. His original thesis work was on things related to predicting binding sites in DNA sequences, but he's recently done work on some evolutionary models for predicting binding sites. The problem being that binding sites disappear and appear. And so on a phylogeny, they don't continue all the way through a phylogeny. They can appear at any time in the phylogeny. Figured out a method to be able to do that. And so maybe you don't have a slot in the mornings, but
I think I'd be happy to have him speak on Thursday morning
instead of you.
Yeah.
No, we won't.
I mean, that would be more relevant.
I don't think
I was thinking maybe I'll send around an email in one of the afternoons later in the week. People who are interested in this
can
get together and Eric can talk about that thing as well.
Okay, thanks. Sorry for being naive about all the genetic elements.